Hi, everybody. Morning.
Good morning.
So this morning I'd like to talk about three manifestations of Zen practice. Those are synchronicity, boundarylessness, and loving kindness. I'm sure there are lots of manifestations, but these are three that I decided to talk about today. And I decided to talk about these three because I was reading the New York Times on April 8th, and there were three articles that I thought, oh, wow. And one of them relates to one of the manifestations, and the other two to two of the others. So the first one, the first article from the New York Times its title is That Jesus in Your Toast. Take a close look at your breakfast. Is that Jesus staring out at you from your toast? Such apparitions can be as lucrative as they are seemingly miraculous. In 2004, a Florida woman named Diane Dizer sold a decade-old grilled cheese sandwich that bore a striking resemblance to the Virgin Mary. She got $28,000 for it on eBay. The psychological phenomena of seeing something significant in an ambiguous stimulus is called pareidolia. Virgin Mary, grilled cheese sandwiches, and other pareidolia remind us that almost any object is open to multiple interpretations. Less understood, however, is what drives some interpretations over others. In a forthcoming paper in the Journal of Cognition, we hope to shed some light on that question. In a series of experiments, we examined awareness of perceptually ambiguous stimuli to see if it was enhanced by the presence of moral content. Over the course of three experiments, we found that participants correctly identified strings of letters as words more often when they formed moral words than when they formed non-moral words. This suggested that moral content gave a boost to perceptually ambiguous stimuli, a shortcut to conscious awareness. We call this phenomenon the moral pop-out effect, which is similar to when you're hungry, you see the grilled cheese sandwich. That's the hunger pop-out effect. Pareidolia are often accompanied by reports that the apparition was welcomed as a sign of hope. For an individual or family suffering through a tough time. For example, Jesus had appeared in Marmite to a woman worried about her ill mother, and a potato chip to a woman concerned about her husband's health. Our finding that moral concerns can alter a person's perceptual experience may help explain why these apparitions seem to appear the way they do. So, interesting. And when I thought about this, I thought about my own grandmother when she was having trouble with her prayer as a Catholic, as a practicing Catholic. A lot of trouble and very discouraged. And one morning she told me about this. One morning she was lying in bed just looking at the wall, she saw Jesus rowing a boat across the wall. And that encouraged her, and she got back into her prayer life. So this ambiguous stimuli is interesting, especially for those of us who sit in meditation facing blank walls, because if anything is ambiguous, it's a blank wall. And if we do retreats or we do long meditations, very often we'll have some kind of vision or hallucination or projection of a grilled cheese sandwich or a Buddha or something. Sometimes it'll be totally nondescript. We can't even figure out what it is. So this is very interesting, but it also led me to think that sometimes, I've been practicing with people for a long time, sometimes people actually, when they're sitting facing the wall, have what seems to be more than just projections. And we can see how the projections of a Buddha or a Jesus or whatever can help you, but they can also limit you if you turn them into something that somehow more than a projection, right? But on the other hand, there are times, many of you will experience this if you do meditation regularly, where you may have a synchronistic moment. Raise your hand if you know the word synchronicity. Just about everybody does, so I don't need to explain it. Okay, a synchronistic moment. For instance, my friend from years ago named Lana was sitting in meditation during a retreat and facing one of these walls that we always face, and she had an image. It just popped up on some second, third day of retreat of her mother bending over. And her mother was outside, and she was bending over. And then Lana had a pain in her forehead. That was the entire experience. And the retreat ended that day, and she called home and found out that her mother was in the hospital. That her mother had been out watering the lawn, bending over watering the lawn, and had a stroke, a blood clot up right up here, where Lana was feeling the pain just at the same time. Pardon?
Will you define the term, please?
Synchronicity? Oh, sure. So synchronicity means that two events which happen at a distance from one another have a correlation, because everything is interdependent. All life is interdependent. And that sometimes you can pick something up which is beyond your normal sensory awareness because of the interdependence of all life. Does that help? Yeah. So that was her entire experience. And of course, it's not surprising in a way that these kinds of things happen at some time. Another experience that a friend of mine talked about, someone who had been practicing with her teacher for years and years, and then her teacher died, and very close to her teacher. And this is not so much looking at the blank wall. I said to her one day, "How was your meditation?" And she said, "Oh, fine." And I said, "Well, does it help you to read so-and-so?" The person had been her teacher. And she said, "Well," who had been dead for a few years. And she said, well, he's always with me." And I said, "Oh, do you see him?" She said, "No." I said, "Do you think about him?" She said, "No." he's just there, and that's where I find quietness. And I said, "Well, where is he? Can you point to a part of your body that he's in?" She said, "No." So that is something more than projection. I'm tentatively putting out there, but if you make a religion out of it, then it becomes a projection. Do you understand what I mean? But tentatively, it actually is related to what we call transmission in Zen. But I'm not going to talk any more about that today. Anyway, so that's the first manifestation, synchronicity. The second manifestation that I'm going to talk about is boundarylessness. And this is from another article in the same section of the New York Times from April 8th, A Rationalist's Mystical Moment. And this is by Barbara Ehrenreich. And actually, this article was not only in the New York Times on April 8th. I picked up the Week magazine yesterday, and I saw it. It made it into the Week magazine, too. And it's not that, well, it's just not that exceptional. It's not that exceptional an article for those of us who are Zen practitioners, but it's very interesting that it made the New York Times. Let's see, what am I going to read about? Okay. This is written by Barbara, and she's reflecting on a time, now I think she's writing this maybe in her 40s or 50s. She's reflecting on a time when she was 17 years old. I was sleep-deprived and probably hypoglycemic that morning in 1959 when I stepped out alone, walked into the streets of Lone Pine, California, bottom of the Sierras in California, a tiny little town, and saw the world, the mountains, the sky, the low scattered buildings suddenly flame into life. There were no visions, no prophetic voices or visits by totemic animals, just this blazing everywhere. Something poured into me, and I poured out into it. It was a furious encounter with a living substance that was coming at me through all things at once, too vast and violent to hold on to, too heartbreakingly beautiful to let go of. It seemed to me that whether you start as a twig or a gorgeous tapestry, you will be recruited into the flame and made indistinguishable from the rest of the blaze. I felt ecstatic and somehow completed, but also shattered. So, this is the interconnectedness that talked about experience of interconnectedness in Zen a lot. And also in all the major mystical traditions, in Christianity, in Sufism, Taoism, it's there. Experience of boundarylessness. Experience of boundarylessness. But at the time, she's 17, she doesn't realize this, and she says, of course I said nothing about this to anyone. Right? Nothing about this to anyone. Since I recognize no deities, and even the notion of an altered state of consciousness was unavailable at the time, I was left with only one explanation. I had had a mental breakdown. And then she talks about when this she doesn't talk much about it, but she talks about the fact that this experience of boundarylessness can be wonderful and lead to wondrous joy, and it cannot be wonderful. Cannot be wonderful. And she doesn't, and lead to, as she said, a mental breakdown. Lead to a mental breakdown. So she doesn't talk about this, but I thought I would talk about it a little bit. So, boundarylessness, all these Chinese Zen masters, and then he had an awakening, and then he had a realization over and over and over again. That's boundarylessness. And it's always wonderful, and whether it becomes a pivotal moment in their lives or not, we don't know, but it's always wonderful. But actually, it's not always wonderful outside of a spiritual context, and even sometimes inside of a spiritual context, it's not wonderful. I just spent time with my grandsons, who are 4 and 8, and my 4-year-old grandson is working on developing a little ego, but he's still got too little an ego. He's very innocent, but you know he's not developed the good internal boundaries. So we were at dinner, and I had to. Well, I'm not even going to the whole thing, but he was misbehaving, and he rushed from the table, and I had to go outside and just kind of be with him and for quite a while. He hasn't developed that ego strength yet. And my 8-year-old grandson has developed quite a bit of ego strength, but he doesn't have any ego resilience yet. You know, we develop ego strength first. He knows what's good and he knows what's bad. He knows how we're supposed to behave and how we're not supposed to behave. There's nothing in between for him at 8 years old. So he's developed the strength, but not the resilience. So Neither of them are ready for boundarylessness. And they may not be for 10, 20 years. That's okay. That's okay. It's okay. It's very important to develop both a solid ego and a resilient ego. And these experiences of boundarylessness, whether they're good, as they are in the Zen sense, or not good, they can occur through many different ways. They can occur through illness, through trauma, like PTSD, through drugs. So the question is, what's the difference? Well, if the experience of boundarylessness, of letting go of everything, of going beyond everything you know, if it means you don't have your ego boundaries accessible anymore, you lost them. That can be kind of freaky. If you develop paranoid delusions to shore up the boundary that's gone, that's hard. That's hard. If you begin to think, oh, boy, I got it. I'm the savior. I'm the enlightened one. Then feelings of omniscience, grandiosity, and so that's one path. But our path is opening up, and the byproduct is love, understanding, connectedness, empathy, joy. But it comes through our meditation practice, through gradually being exposed to the potential of boundarylessness. In a non-traumatic way, in a non-traumatic situation. So the two things that are important in regard to boundarylessness are set and setting. Set. What's the set? Do you have a meditation practice? Do you have a teacher? Do you have a community? So that means that you have a set. You have a structure to move beyond structure, and which you can return to if you get lost in structurelessness, if you get lost in emptiness. Those are crucial. Those are crucial. And then what's the setting? Is the setting positive? Sitting in meditation, are you sitting in a calm environment with people who are respectful and supportive? Or are you out at the mall on New Year's Eve or something? I wouldn't recommend doing boundarylessness then. So that's very interesting, I think. And we don't talk much about that, but I thought it was good to talk about it today, so I did. And then, of course, a lifetime process is to move beyond ego, but also to continue to develop stronger ego and more resilient ego. So often therapy is a great complement to meditation. And not always, but often. Often it's a necessary complement. Sometimes not, but sometimes. So it's both on. It's both and. And of course, we say emptiness, to know emptiness is wonderful, but emptiness is form. Take care of both. And if meds help you, if you have a diagnosed mental illness, then meds can help you a lot. They can help you shore up the boundaries. They can help you calm down and feel hopeful enough so that you can then move beyond your ego structure. So that's the second manifestation. And the third manifestation. Okay, this article also in the New York Times. This is written by an author, a guy who's a writer. And I'm going to read most of this. Since he's a writer, it's very well written. So why not? I'll read most of it, and then I'll talk about it. 7 years into writing a novel, I started to be constantly aware of how little I had managed to accomplish. I would sit at my desk at 2 a.m. in the morning, unable to sleep, and drink pot after pot of tea and try to write. One December morning, the crisis finally came. I had lain down on my living room sofa and found I could not get up. The idea of another year ending with a book not done overwhelmed me. A day went by, and then two. My wife would stand beside me with her face full of fear. Finally desperate, she phoned a good friend of mine. He drove in from out of town, 3 hours away, and took me for a ride in his car. I was like a sobbing infant on the ride. But my friend was like a father who drives till his child falls asleep, soothed. When I returned to my apartment, I lay down once more on the couch. Again, I felt the weight of my stalled novel. Any of you who are writers, I think, can resonate with this. But something had changed. My friend's kindness kept drawing my attention, the way a piece of glass at the bottom of a stream can keep blinking in sunlight and pull your eye. Each time I thought of him, I was soothed. In my Hindu household when I was growing up, he grew up an Indian. Strange men, not priests or gurus, but engineers, accountants, candy shop owners, would come to the house and perform bizarre rituals, claiming that God had visited them in a dream and told them of a magical cure that would fix things. Having grown up like this, among so many crackpot rituals, I found nothing alien in exploring oddball ideas. So, sitting on the bench by the river that day, I remember having read in Reader's Digest that when you are feeling bad, one way to make yourself feel better is to pray for others. I began to pray for the people who were passing by. I prayed for the nanny pushing a stroller. I prayed for the young woman jogging by in spandex. I prayed for the little boy pedaling his bicycle. I prayed that each of them got the same things that I wanted for myself, that they have good health, peace of mind, financial security. By focusing on others and their needs, my own problems seemed less unique and somehow less pressing. After this, when I would sit at my desk trying to write and despair welled up, I knew what to do. I prayed, not for myself or for the ability to write, but for others, whether dead or alive, known to me or not, William Faulkner as much as the crazy old lady in the grocery store. During my breakdown, many tiny things I had not even registered before had begun to torment me with guilt. I used to steal Splenda from Starbucks. But I stopped wishing away the guilt and started acting in ways I didn't need to feel guilty about, even a little. No more stealing Splenda. No more mixing recyclables. All this praying and punctilious honesty may seem absurd, but it did let me finish my novel. The style of it is very different from my first novel. The nouns in my sentences used to fall in just a few places, but now they seem to bop around, nudging themselves into places I never would have thought to place them. Before, each paragraph had pushed the reader directly into the next. Now there is space between my paragraphs, and I have trust in my reader's patience and generosity to stay with me without shepherding him. Just as my parents were always looking for ways, however ludicrous, to wake my brother, I found that I am constantly on the lookout for ways to keep my mind quiet so that I might live and work in peace. Recently, I read an interview of an actor who said that when he needs to change his behavior towards someone, he merely thinks, I love you, as he is talking to the person. I called my parents a few weeks ago on the second anniversary of my brother's death. My father began telling me that he felt abandoned by my brother, that my brother's dying feels like him leaving us. As he spoke, I started thinking, I love you. I love you. My usual response at this point would have been to tell my father that he needed to focus on the future, that what was past was past. Instead, I told my father that he was wonderful, that he should think of how brave he had been to take care of this poor sick son for all those years, that his devotion had been heroic. However odd my reasons may seem, I'm glad I said this. So that's what we call metta, isn't it, in Buddhism? Metta, loving kindness. Very simple. He didn't even know about it, about any religion. He'd given up on Hinduism and become an atheist. Loving kindness. So I've talked in my talks here over the years about my relationship with my father, and I did something similar with my father. Two different stages in my life. In my 20s, after my father had refused to talk with me, written me off, told me he made a big deal out of telling me he disinherited me, which made me think, oh, he must have quite a bit of money. I would say the first 3 or 4 years of my Zen practice, I was just pissed at him. So I didn't work on it. I didn't work at it. His values sucked. He was materialistic, da 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 da. But about, I would say, 4 years into my Zen practice, with him having essentially written me off, I began thinking, oh, gee, I'm a Zen practitioner. This is my dad. I can let go of this stuff. I can just talk to him on the phone and bring up things that I know interest him, and listen to him instead of talking about what he considered weird, I guess, dysfunctional life. I guess that's what he thought. And it worked. I wasn't quite as bold as this guy. meaning that, but anyway, if I had just told my father how much I loved him, he wouldn't have gotten that. He wouldn't have gotten that. He would have thought, well, what's he up to now? So I worked at it. And so in the space of 5, 7, 8 years, our relationship turned around, and he was again my friend, and again my comrade, and he was there for me. He wanted to spend time with my grandkids, so that worked. And then about 20 years after that, my father. By this time, my father's in his late 80s. 20 years after that. And he's becoming very cantankerous. He has some kind of dementia, and it's really cantankerous. So my approach of listening to him and talking to him about stuff that interests him, it doesn't go anywhere, because he lots of times he won't even open his eyes, and he's just going to open one and look at me. And my sister and I have taken him out of his home. He doesn't want to be taken out of his home, so he's obviously really angry at us for doing that, and put him in not a nursing home, but put him with some people who will take care of him, whom he didn't know ahead of time. But in that case, what I did was what I call backward seeing vidya to see back. That is, I remembered the good memories of doing stuff with him as a kid, and so I brought those to his bedside. I brought those memories up, so I was able to sit there and just be with him, even without any response. And again, it in this case, it didn't work for him because he still stayed pretty immobile, but it worked for me, and he would open his eyes and look at me, and even smiled once which he had never done for years. So this is an ongoing practice that we do. And it moves us beyond our self-consciousness. All three of these practices, synchronicity, boundarylessness, and loving-kindness, move us beyond. And they're all important parts of Zen practice, important parts of our lives, whether we're doing formal Zen or not. So the self is very important. We need the self. And the self is the one that figures out what kind of loving kindness to do, how to say it, how to be there with someone, how to manifest it with them. But we also need to move beyond the self. And actually, if we give ourselves away in bodhisattva activities, praying or just bringing up good vibes for someone, or giving up some food to a homeless person, we come out of ourselves. It doesn't matter how deep our depression is. We come out of ourselves. And we feel that interconnectedness that's always present in the world. Always present. So, years ago, my teacher gave a talk, Zen Beyond Self-Consciousness. And these are three ways of moving beyond self-consciousness: synchronicity, boundarylessness, and loving kindness. But when we say beyond, we mean not obliterating self-consciousness, taking care of self-consciousness. We're lucky to have self-consciousness at all. So that's what I want to say for today. Questions, comments about any of the three or anything?
Metta practice is a wonderful thing to do in the line at the airport. The lines, you know, they're really long. And you're like this, so you're seeing these people come at you. And it's a wonderful thing.
So metta, for those of you who don't know, that just means loving kindness in Pali. And Maitri in Sanskrit, loving kindness. That's what it means. Thank you, Rosemary. Yes?
What was the word again for seeing something in nothing?
Pareidolia. Yeah, I'd never heard that word before either. Seeing something in nothing. What else? What else is on your mind? What thoughts did this stimulate in you that you'd like to ask about or share? Pamela.
I just want to thank you for talking about this. I think it's a hard subject to talk about and a hard subject for people to hear. And I thought it was just beautiful. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Yeah, either of you, both of you.
Well, it might be a little longer, but it actually did, when you were talking about pareidolia, it actually did make me think about something that I think about often. And what that is that it seems like quite often things are what we make them.
Yes.
And whether that's a substance, like something that we're addicted to, or somebody's word, or a cloud in the sky, or somebody's feet.
Yes.
What should somebody talk about? And I'm from San Francisco, so I'm sorry, I'm going to talk about this very openly. I heard somebody talk once about how fetishes it's not about the thing itself, it's about the meaning that we place on the thing. And that's kind of what it made me think about. So I think the thing is kind of in. I mean, what you think of this, I think that's often the thing with words or other substances. It's not about the thing, but it's about the meaning that we place on the thing.
Could you guys hear her out there? No, you couldn't hear her. Well, can I summarize this, or do you want to say it again louder?
Go ahead. I think you know what I mean.
Okay. Well, what she's talking about, the fact that we seem to do a lot of projection in many, many different ways, and that our projection isn't just manifests itself in many ways, and usually it's related to the meaning that we make of things. So that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, but it actually has nothing to do with the object that is triggering us,
uh-huh,
and feel a certain way.
Yeah.
But that it has more to do, how we're feeling about something has more to do with the meaning that is placed on.
Yeah, so how, did you hear that? Yes, that's right. So that's a good, that's... Yes, so I mean, and that's actually what you've stated is a Zen truism. It's a Zen truism.
Okay.
Yeah, but you did it very well, and it does apply to all kinds of things, like fetish, including things like fetishes. I'm also from San Francisco. Although I've been gone a long time. I don't know. I don't know what new fetishes have been developed during the time I've been gone.
But I've just been here not even a month.
Pardon?
I have not even been here a month.
Oh, I see.
I wanted to get here to kind of find
some. I see. Well, welcome. Welcome. It's a great place to be.
Thank you.
Did you want to say something?
I was going to ask if you think
yeah.
If there could be some boundarylessness also in that projection.
Uh-huh. You're asking if there can be?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. There can be. Projection can open into boundarylessness. And if so, that's pretty cool. I'm thinking more in a meditative context when I'm saying it's pretty cool. Let me just think about this from a sort of review my own. You can see your teacher on the wall, your dead teacher, or your teacher who's still in England or wherever he is. You can see him on the wall. He just comes up in the meditation, and you know he's a projection. But you all of a sudden you feel very still, and that stillness and his image goes entirely. But you still feel an incredible stillness all around you, and his image is gone. So those images, those spiritual images, Jesus, Buddha, your teacher, that can be very, very powerful to moving, powerful catalysts to moving into boundarylessness. May not be. You may get, may not be, but they can be. Sure. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Can you tell me what Ben says about, you know, in loving kindness and meditation, the opposite of if you would have continued to stay angry and not spoken to your father, where in Zen practice does it say that, you know, my assumptions hold you back or not allow?
Well, I can hardly. I mean, when there's real boundarylessness in the Zen sense, you feel connected to everyone. If my dad is not part of that, then what's this interconnectedness? I mean, it's a heart. Your heart opens, and your heart opens indiscriminately, because that's boundarylessness, is indiscriminate. So, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Tim, so what you're saying is there's no room for hypocrisy. If you're Zen.
Well, right. There's no room for hypocrisy. That's right. But there's plenty of room. There's plenty of room. So if you feel like you, you know, we're a hypocrite. That's okay. Just let it go. There's plenty of room. There's always plenty of room. But you're right, too. But not so right. Because this is it. Boundarylessness. This is it. This is the whole deal. Well, it's not the whole deal because you've got to take care of your boundaries. That's part of boundarylessness. Yeah.
As you were talking about the first one, synchronicity, I think that a lot of us have had mild experiences of some kind of synchronicity where suddenly things just seem more alive and more vivid. But if we don't have any way to frame them, like, you know, some idea of interconnectedness or something like that to give them meaning, we tend to just kind of shrug them off.
Mm-hmm.
But when you were talking about the one, when you read about the woman who had that fierce experience, which, you know, can't be shrugged off, I remember something that I read that Joseph Campbell said, who I think has had, you know, many of these really fierce experiences of boundlessness just by reading him and his total acceptance of their of the truth of them. He said once that, you know, this woman thought that she had a mental break, some kind of psychotic break. And what Joseph Campbell said when he was talking about these experiences that people have around the world, he said that the people who actually do have a psychotic break from one of these fierce experiences, he said, he said that they drown in the same water that the mystic swims in.
Mm-hmm.
And so yes. He just went on to talk about how important it was to have some kind of preparation.
That's right. Yes, that's wise. Joseph Campbell was wise. Mm-hmm. Did you hear what she said? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Anybody else?
I remember for school, I had a religious experience in my religion class. And so we only had a couple of weeks studying Buddhism. But I'm curious, people here said the most important thing about it is like the sort of well-being and happiness, or if it's like not harming others, or what would be like the most significant...
What would be... So you're asking what's the most... Not getting caught on evaluating what's high and what's low, but just appreciating this very instant, this very being. Your question, your smile.
Well, I'm trying to understand that the well-being part, but like the nirvana part, is a little bit more complex. Where you're going is hard to understand, but where you are right now, I think it's easier to understand. I don't know.
Anything more? Okay.